It is Friday, April the 8th, and this is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us. Coming up, a VOA connection to the Panama Papers. Also ahead, changes underway in Libya.
It's quite clear that some of the militias who were supporting the Salvation Government did not like the idea of folding up and accepting the UN-supported government.
Migrants on the move, who U.S. women support for president, plus a popular American TV program comes to an end. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. The Panama Papers consist of more than 1.5 million documents leaked by a Panamanian law firm that detailed hidden offshore accounts held by world leaders and celebrities. International Consortium of Investigative Journalists, in a collaborative effort by more than 300 journalists from more than 70 countries, analyzed the financial data. Ray Choto, senior editor of VOA's Zimbabwe service, is among the journalists who worked on that project. My colleague Sarah Williams spoke with him about his involvement.
I started digging the dagger maybe a couple of months ago. And again, you may have access to the data, but that's not a story on its own. Yeah, you need to understand the data, the trend of the information and the paper trail that is in there. You are opening, let's say, a file that has got more than 20,000, files on one individual, and you need to go that single by single of the files to make sure that you get the information, you understand what is going on, and then sit back and think about the information, whether there is something that is worth following. So some of the stuff, really, it has been stuff that has been out in the media. Some of it, you could tell it was just a simple business transaction and you just leave it as it is. But where you raise the question, that's when you need to sort of find the answers as to why are you raising that question. Is there some break of the law involved, some violation of some laws and everything? So that took quite some time, really.
Now, this involves, there's a list of people involved in this. There are also a list of leaders of countries, either they or members of their families or close associates. I'm thinking Britain's Prime Minister David Cameron, Russian President Vladimir Putin. There are others. There is also an in-law, relative by marriage, of Chinese President Xi Jinping is named, a number of them. When your team was beginning this, did you have an idea that some of these world leaders would have links to this whole situation with this firm in Panama?
No, to begin with, I had no idea. As for myself, I did not have an idea. It was just the data that I had to look through and look at anything that has to do with Zimbabwe. You raised the issue of leaders. Yes, we came across some people named or closely linked to ZANU-PF or to the president of Zimbabwe, President Robert Mugabe. This is how kind of his business associates, people who have been funding the party for a long period of time, which is not new information as far as Zimbabweans are concerned. So I was mainly interested in finding something that is very new. You talk about Prime Minister David Cameron, you talk about President Vladimir Putin of Russia. Those were not our area, like as a Zimbabwean, because we had other journalists who were working on those. And one thing that we agreed in common was that there was no one who was going to scoop anyone. We're going to work as a team, collaborate. Where you find information which could be helpful to a friend, you can always give a heads up, say, oh, there is this on Mugabe. I mean, do you think you might be interested? I have received those things and I looked at the information. I looked at it. It was nothing new. It has been in the media. We've covered it before. Mm-hmm. But somebody in Germany might find it very interesting. So I was looking for information that is new, that is something that has to do with Zimbabwe, wherever it is, be it in Britain, be it wherever, but as long as it is a Zimbabwean connection, because that was the primary responsibility that I had on the project, was to tackle Zimbabwean issues.
So, but Mugabe himself is not named in this?
Mugabe is named in the correspondence.
So his associates?
His associates, yes, yeah. But there is no way, and I'm not really going to really dig too much into it, that we can say this is what Mugabe is doing, but his associates are named in the correspondence, and there is information, because you're dealing with individuals. We had to go through vetting and everything. I would give you an example of John Bredenkamp, where Mossack Fonseca, raised an issue that, no, this guy is under UN sanctions, he's under the EU sanctions, he's under the Yeah, U.S. sanctions. And they go through him, and then through those documents, they find that he is on the sanctions list because of his association with President Robert Mugabe. Is that a new story to Zimbabweans? To some, maybe, but the majority of Zimbabwe are aware about that. But what is new is the things that we'll be looking at. I mean, are there any new development? Because we've covered those stories. Jordan Bredenkamp's involvement in supporting ZANU-PF and Mugabe's party, that's not something new. We have covered about it, and it's on record. But what we are looking at is some new information that would give us some new insights into the operations of John Bredenkamp or President Robert Mugabe.
Will the investigations continue?
The investigations are continuing, and we still have more stories that are going to come, especially on our part, on the Zimbabwe side. We still have more Zimbabwean stories with the Zimbabwean angle that are going to come out of the investigations.
That is Ray Choto. He's a senior editor of VOA's Zimbabwe service. He was among the ICIJ journalists who worked on the Panama Papers. He was speaking with International Edition's Sarah Williams.
The news never stops, so keep current on your mobile device with VOA News. Just go to m.voanews.com/English for instant, up-to-the-minute news and entertainment. Check m.voanews.com/English on your handheld device for news as it happens. Stay connected with a fast-changing world with m.voanews.com/English.
Migrants and refugees in camps on the Greek island of Lesbos continue to be worried they might be deported back to Turkey under a controversial European Union program. Osama Alktiba is 27 years old, a Syrian refugee from Damascus.
We came to Greece on 20 March, so we were in Moria, and they gave us two choices. One of them to apply asylum in Greece. The second is to go back to Turkey, so we choose to apply asylum in Greece.
In return, EU countries are to take in Syrians with legitimate asylum claims. Nearly 3,100 asylum applications have already been filed in Lesbos. Elsewhere, more migrants are again using the Mediterranean route to Europe, which can be dangerous, a dangerous sea journey from North Africa. Thursday, the Italian Coast Guard rescued hundreds of migrants. For more on that story, VOA's Joe DiCapua spoke to reporter Antonella Sferazza in Palermo about all of this.
A few days ago, 1,500 migrants, including many women and children, have been picked up in about a dozen rescue operations at sea in only 2 days. So the number of migrants rescued in Italian Coast Guard and Navy operation is up sharply from the same period last year. Statistics for the first 3 months of this year showed more than 18,000 migrants have been rescued from smugglers' boats in distress in waters between Libya and Sicily.
So what happens after the Italian Coast Guard rescues these migrants? Where do they go?
Let me tell you first that in the past years, the largest group of migrants arriving in Italy were Syrians. While now this flow has significantly decreased since Syrians prefer the Greek route into Europe. So the majority of those arriving in Italy are people fleeing Nigeria, Gambia and Senegal, and then Mali, Ivory Coast, Somalia, Eritrea and Ethiopia. Once picked up, the migrants are ferried to hotspot processing centers. The hotspot processing centers are 6 in Italy, 5 in Sicily, but only 3 operating. This is the new European approach system. The general idea is to create an area of disembarkation where migrants are screened, identified, and fingerprinted against their will if necessary. Those claiming asylum are immediately channeled into an asylum procedure and hosted in a reception center, while those who are not considered in need of protection are returned to the countries of origin. But the problem is that several human rights associations and the Italian Parliament Committee on Migration have been denouncing the estimate used to separate real asylum seekers from those who are just economic migrants. One of the main tools used in the Italian hotspot is the so-called foglio notizia, an information sheet. It is a very short questionnaire collecting some general personal details and crucially asking migrants what is the reason of their arrival. The questionnaire provides a number of tick boxes, and if for any reason you seek work among your options, you are automatically classified as an economic migrant, so an illegal migrant. The truth is that people do not fully understand the questionnaire. We know many refugees who select work because they want to show their willingness to integrate economically, and for that reason they are denied the right of asylum. As a result, the Italian Parliament Committee on Migration said that this system is very discriminatory and it is increasing clandestinity. That is, migrants that stay in Italy, they don't go back in their country also because they don't have money to do it. They stay in Italy hiding their identity and living by their wits.
Reporter Antonella Sferrazza speaking from Palermo with VOA's Joe DiCapua. This is VOA.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of VOA's Encounter. Join me and two advocates from the world of politics, public policy, or academia debating critical and controversial issues of our day, bringing depth, perspective, and insight to the world around us. You can listen to Encounter on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Encounter every Saturday and Sunday on the Voice of America.
Hello, Africa. I'm James Butte, host of VOA's Daybreak Africa. VOA. When news breaks, VOA Africa is there, bringing you the news as it happens. Listen to Daybreak Africa Monday through Friday at 3, 4, 5, and 6 hours UTC. And our 5 minute newscast come to you at the top of each hour. VOA Africa, your trusted source of information.
This is VOA's International Edition. After calling on his ministers to step down from their post to make way for a UN-backed unity government, the prime minister of the Islamist administration in Libya's capital, Tripoli, told them to continue their mission and threatened to prosecute anyone working with the new government. The confusion comes a week after the prime minister-designate of the UN-backed Government of National Accord and his colleagues arrived by boat in Tripoli from Tunisia to attempt to exert their authority. U.S. State Department spokesman Mark Toner called for universal acceptance of the new authority.
Now is the time for all Libyans to continue to support the government of National Accord. And we urge all Libyans to continue facilitating a peaceful handover of power so Libya's new leaders can begin the hard work of restoring stability to the country, which is absolutely urgent and vital.
UN-backed administration finalized in December is the result of months of negotiations, but has not been formally backed by Libya's rival Western and Eastern administrations. Middle East Institute senior scholar Zubair Iqbal tells VOA's Victor Beatty the confusion appears to reflect divisions within Libya's political and militia factions.
It's quite clear that some of the militias who were supporting the Salvation Government did not like the idea of folding up and accepting the UN-supported government. And they're a fairly strong militia because they're the ones who provide protection to the movement of oil that Tripoli government sells. Second issue is that there was a deal that was worked out with the UN-supported government. Underlying it, the idea was that a part of the cabinet positions will go to the Salvation Government ministers. And those ministers were the ones who were agreed to cease holding the government in place and move on with the UN-based and the UN-supported government. It seemed that that didn't really work out. Or maybe it's still in the pipeline and something will work out of it. But at this moment, what we see is that those understandings that were reached are still in the stage of understandings and not being implemented.
Can something be salvaged out of this?
I hope so, but I don't think so. The third thing, which I'm really quite concerned about, is that the Trablus-based government, which was understood to have followed on the same steps as the Salvation Government, refused to do it. So what it has done is this, that it has weakened the position of the Salvation Government. And they're angry. They're very concerned. And they want to, quote-unquote, strengthen their position, and that strengthening the position would imply significant compromises between the UN-supported and the Salvation Government. So something may come up. We don't know what's going to come up, but that could very well be a mixed bag which will remain in place and will confuse situations even more.
There is obviously some concern given the rise of Islamic State in Libya, as well as the human trafficking that's going into Europe through Libya, and the chaos among the militia since Muammar Gaddafi stepped down, that something be resolved sooner rather than later.
Of course. No, but you see, we are already very late in resolving the problem. See, what has happened is that all the militias that came into power or into prominence, I may say, are the ones who have stakes in the economic returns. And those stakes are getting bigger with time. And they're not going to give up those stakes unless there is a commensurate compensation. That compensation is not there, number one. Number two, who is going to provide that compensation? How are these militias going to be demilitarized? How are they going to be inducted into a government? Who is going to lead those armed forces? So all these things are still up in the air. They're the major imponderables. And for that reason, I don't see how you can expect the militias to lead the process of reconciliation. They're the ones who are going to be brought in kicking and screaming. But that will require fundamental political understandings among the various political power bases.
At his Middle East Institute senior scholar Zubair Iqbal, he was speaking with VOA's Victor Beatty. If the U.S. presidential campaign were to come down to Republican Donald Trump versus Democrat Hillary Clinton, 60% of American women polled in a recent CNN survey said they would cast their ballots for Clinton. We get more now from VOA correspondent Arup Pandey.
As a woman, who'd have thought? I come from Africa, you know, I would have thought that I would start a business in America, you know?
The last year has not been without its challenges for ice cream shop owner Ann Siegel. The Ugandan-American and mother of a young daughter used her family's savings to get her year-old Laurel, Maryland business off the ground.
It's so easy for a man to go to the bank and they give him a loan. Me, a woman, what do you do? Oh, I'm a housewife. Oh, yeah, really? Nobody's going to give you a loan, you know?
Margot Dorfman, CEO of the U.S. Women's Chamber of Commerce, says the challenges of being a female business owner are reflected in the statistics. While women own 36% of all U.S. companies, they generate only 4% of all U.S. annual revenues.
We have been undervalued for decades now. The fact that we still don't have fair pay, we have to leave corporate America to start our own businesses, to maybe get fair pay and the family-friendly work environment, and still struggle when we've got into the marketplace.
On who might best address the struggle, Dorfman says Democratic presidential candidate Hillary Clinton wins her organization's endorsement.
She is committed to making sure that small businesses have access to capital and access to markets, and is very interested in the access to affordable health care.
Buki Openuga, a fellow Clinton supporter, grew her Atlanta-based digital marketing company using high-interest credit cards. In the presidential campaign, the Nigerian-American says she is paying close attention to women's workplace issues.
Some people don't necessarily want to go the entrepreneurial route, but they're having to essentially come out of the workplace and become 1099 workers because they're having to choose between a paycheck or being able to take care of a sick child at home. So these are some of the issues that I think I'm going to be paying attention to, and a lot of women really should.
Back in Maryland, Ann Siegel is paying close attention to the economy as she works to make her shop profitable. Though she voted for Barack Obama, she says she's disappointed with Democrats and is now looking in a different direction.
Who is Trump? He's created a job. You know, he's employing people. When it comes to economy, at least he knows better than the other guys who are running around telling us what to do.
Regardless of whom they support, both Siegel and Openuga say American women should ensure their voices are heard come November. Arup Pandey, VOA News, Washington.
And now let's check in with International Edition social media correspondent G. Abby Lee about how politics is trending online. Hey, G.
Hi, Steve. It's hashtag Hillary So Qualified. Kim Frederick, who goes by the handle Kim Frederick, that's F-R-E-D-E-R-I on Twitter, created the hashtag. She describes herself as native Houstonian and a Clinton superfan, basically. She tweeted this Wednesday night, "After creating number one globally trending hashtag tonight, I am going to bed. My anger exploded on Twitter. Watch it, slanders."
Just curious why that particular hashtag started trending.
Great question. It's because the two Democratic contenders are raising questions about each other's qualifications to lead the country. Former Secretary of State Hillary Clinton started the conversation after losing Tuesday's Wisconsin primary. She said this about Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders. "Like a lot of people, I am concerned that some of his ideas just won't work because the numbers don't add up. In a number of important areas, he doesn't have a plan at all."
And I'm sure Senator Sanders retorted.
Yes, he did. He said, "She has attacked me for being unqualified. And if I'm attacked for being unqualified, I will respond in kind." And this is his quote-unquote attack. "People might wonder about your qualifications when you supported virtually every trade agreements that have cost the American workers millions of decent-paying jobs."
I understand, G. Just how popular is it?
Sadly for Clinton, it kind of backfired by Thursday morning. Sanders supporters are using the hashtag ironically, criticizing Clinton for voting in favor of the Iraq War and her paid speeches to Wall Street.
Okay, what else is trending?
Yet another story on the Democratic frontrunner Hillary Clinton. A video of her swiping the Metro card multiple times at a New York subway station is making the rounds on social media. She visited the Bronx, and many people are saying she doesn't even know how to use a public transit system too well. But it's unclear whether that was her mistake or the machine malfunctioning. Steve?
Yeah, many thanks to you, G. That is International Edition's G. Abby Lee. You know, you can follow G on Twitter at G. Abby Lee. I'm there as well at VOA Norman, and you can follow International Edition on Twitter at VOA underscore IE. This is VOA.
This is BizBeat.
The sharp drop in global oil prices has forced Gabon to look to other areas to expand its economy. Outside of Libreville, the government's created an economic hub for the wood industry. President Ali Bongo. He says we've set up a national timber fund, which will play a role in ensuring that there's fluidity and a good relationship between customers and suppliers. The industrial wood zone is known as the NCOC Special Zone, where 7,000 people are employed and brings in $190 million in tax revenue for the country. But environmentalist Mark Ona Isangui says industrialization has had problems. He says illegal logging is happening at levels never seen before. As the government clamps down on illegal activity, authorities are hopeful that if Gabon diversifies with timber and manufacturing and tourism, the country can become an economic power in West Africa in 10 years. For VOA's BizBeat, I'm Philip Alexio.
This is VOA's International Edition. Good to have you with us today. After 15 seasons and launching the careers of such pop singers as Kelly Clarkson, of course, Carrie Underwood on the countryside, and Jennifer Hudson, American Idol has gone off the air. Did so just a few hours ago. International Edition's David Byrd talked with VOA Soul Lounge host Shauna Renee about the show and its legacy.
The producers of American Idol are keenly aware that the landscape is changing a bit, that particular arena, that sort of like talent contest reality show arena is crowded. And I think also it's about saying we were the first, we were the best, and maybe we need to get out of this before it, there's a term called jumps the shark, meaning it's just, it's getting to the point where now people are getting tired of it. It's no longer good. It's going to lose its reputation, the glory. So let's just kind of jump off the ship before it sinks, if you will.
And it was the prototype for several programs. I mean, Simon Cowell, the original producer of what was called Pop Idol in Britain, brought it to America, and he did American Idol for several seasons. Then he left and went and did The X Factor, which is another singing judging show. You've also got America's Got Talent, which has got a panel of judges. You've got The Voice. Mm-hmm. Then you've got Dancing with the Stars, So You Think You Can Dance. It's the same show, basically, with different slightly different content.
It is. And what's really interesting is before American Idol, when you thought about reality show, so you thought about Survivor or The Real World, the I don't know if Amazing Race was out at that time, but this was the first time when I think Americans here, and I'm sure this was also the case overseas, felt like they could participate. They had a vested interest in what was going on because they got to choose the winner. As before, we were just sort of observing what was going on in reality. This time, as viewers, we were participating in creating a certain reality. And that was very exciting. And I read somewhere, interestingly enough, that American Idol was largely responsible for the increased usage of text messaging, because when they first started to introduce text messaging in the voting process, many people weren't using it. And Ryan Seacrest literally had to spend like 4 minutes during the show explaining to people how to text message.
That was also when texts cost you money.
That's when they cost you money, absolutely. And now you don't even text. Now you can go online and you can vote online. There's so many different ways, via Facebook, Twitter.
They have an app.
Some of these shows
have an app, and they actually have the performer's face, and it's like, you know, vote for this person, and you touch the face, and boom, your vote has been registered. Thank you.
Right. So interesting to see how the show and technology have grown together.
So what do you think the legacy of American Idol is going to be?
Well, I think the one thing that we will walk away with is, as I said earlier, it changed the way Americans interacted with television. I think that was probably the biggest thing. It is the first show that I remember being fully interactive in the way that it is. And I think, too, I mean, Kelly Clarkson, Carrie Underwood, Jennifer Hudson. I mean, these are huge names when we talk about American popular culture. American Idol was responsible for introducing the country to, and the world, really, to our favorite pop stars and country music stars and R&B stars. That's the other thing that I loved about American Idol. Though there was some controversy for a few years, they were the artists that won across various genres.
So are you an American Idol fan? Who is your favorite winner? What do you think about it going away? Well, you can hit Shauna up on Twitter. She is at VOA Lady DJ or at VOA underscore music. And you can hear Shauna's show, The Soul Lounge, on our website, voanews.com.
And many thanks to you, Dave, and to Shauna as well. Listen, here's something. American Idol alumnus Jennifer Hudson has been on Broadway for a while. Well, she's being replaced by Tony and Grammy winner Heather Headley in Broadway's current revival of The Color Purple. Headley's credits, you might know, are The Lion King. She did that on Broadway, also playing the diva in The Bodyguard. That was on stage in London. Her CDs include This Is Who I Am, Audience of One, and The Only One in the World. She's definitely worth checking out her music, and you should do that when you have the opportunity. Thanks for tuning into The Voice of America on International Edition as well. For our director, Tracy Carter, our engineer, Jimmy Cook, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. Have a great Friday.
Next, an international public service announcement by the United States government.
On June 25th, 1996, members of the Saudi Hezbollah terrorist group attacked the Khobar Towers apartment complex used to house U.S. and foreign military personnel near Dhahran, Saudi Arabia. The attackers drove a tanker truck filled with plastic explosives into the parking lot and detonated it, all but destroying the nearest building. The attack killed 19 U.S. servicemen and one Saudi citizen and wounded 372 others of many different nationalities. Abdul Karim Hussein Mohammed al-Nasser, a Saudi citizen, helped plan and carry out the attack. A U.S. federal court has indicted him for conspiracy to use weapons of mass destruction against U.S. nationals, conspiracy to destroy U.S. property, and related charges. Al-Nasser stands approximately 5 foot 8 inches or 173 centimeters tall and has black hair and brown eyes. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $5 million for information leading to al-Nasser's arrest or conviction. The U.S. guarantees that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate and the tip line at www.rewardsforjustice.net or email information to rfj@state.gov.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
It's for what's the universe?